From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Massachusetts lawmakers are finally voting this afternoon on a $40 billion state budget compromise, and it comes with a warning.
This budget does have pain, areas of pain.
Also, 2 years after his arrest, we hear from the mother of Alex Ciccolo, the man arrested on suspicion of terrorism after his father, a Boston police captain, turned him in.
He is very compassionate. He has a deep respect and reverence for all living things. I'm sure some people are out there saying, yeah, right, but he literally would not hurt a fly.
And Lou Cove's coming-of-age tale.
In 1978, I served as campaign manager for Playgirl's Mr. November in his bid to become Man of the Year in 1979. And it worked, and he won, and I got to skip my bar mitzvah.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman, and it is time for our Week in Review.
This budget is not without pain.
House and Senate lawmakers are voting this afternoon on a $40 billion state budget compromise. Here's Senator Karen Spilka, who chairs the Ways and Means Committee.
It's clear that the state is facing a shortfall in revenue that will have an impact on real people's lives. And there are cuts throughout this budget.
The compromise plan comes amid stalled negotiations over changes to the voter-approved recreational marijuana law, and as Governor Charlie Baker called on lawmakers yesterday to get the bills on his desk as soon as possible.
Well, I'm not one to tell the legislature how to do their job. I just want some progress on executing on the job, which means I would hope that sometime soon we'll see a budget and a bill on marijuana.
In the middle of a lot not going on, there's been a lot going on Beacon Hill. We'll talk about all of this happening and much more with our panelists this week. Right now, Michael Curry, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And also we have Tiziana Deering, co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College and a member of WBUR's Executive Advisory Board. Welcome.
Thank you.
And very nice to meet both of you, because it's the first for me.
Nice to meet you.
So we've all been watching and waiting. The state has been operating with a supplemental budget since July 1st, and when was the beginning of the fiscal year. The budget, this one, avoids tax increases and mostly holds spending flat at state agencies. I'm just going to list really quickly a few of the things we know thus far. $4.7 billion in state aids to city and towns, $400 million in cuts, appropriates $2 million for costs associated with regulation, possession, and sales of marijuana. And the budget solves an $837 million budget gap, but we're not exactly sure right at this time how it does this. What's your reaction in the immediate to what you've heard?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think, you know, folks have been waiting with bated breath around what this budget would look like. And I think there's still some uncertainty with tax revenue. So we're not surprised that there are cuts. I think folks, the advocates, are going to start combing through it, and they're doing it right now to figure out what those cuts mean for consumers, for beneficiaries, for residents. And then there'll be some conversation about what happens going forward. But I'm not surprised. I think we have to have a serious conversation in this Commonwealth about revenue, that quite frankly, our values and the things we want to invest in aren't being supported by the way we raise money.
So this is like a Band-Aid right now because we didn't, you know, because the work didn't get done by July 1st. We were talking just before the show started about transparency, and this budget was crafted behind closed doors by a six-person conference committee. It is the way business can be run. It was filed early this morning after 9 o'clock, 9:30. Is there a question of transparency now, Tiziana Deering? I mean, are we trying to... Right now, we're trying to sort through still in this hour what's cut, what's not cut.
Yes, there's a huge issue here. Right now, we're trying to still sort through what's been cut. You're asking me what I think about it, and my informed answer is, I don't know, because we're still trying to figure out what's in it. And yet, both chambers of the state legislature are preparing to vote on it.
Right.
And then, you know, either already have or are preparing to in the next hour or so.
Yeah.
You know, this is a $40 billion budget. I used to run a $40 million organization. If I had delivered my annual budget to my board of directors 7 hours hours before they had to approve it, we would have all been guilty of gross, you know, sort of negligence to our fiduciary responsibility. So I don't know how to feel about this budget other than, in general, I'm pretty sure where we have a revenue problem, it's low-income families that wind up suffering.
Okay, I want to ask you about this before we go into understanding a little bit more about the Medicaid program and how that fits. So I was reading on the State House News Service just in the last few hours. They wrote about Governor Baker is planning to raid trust funds to balance last year's budget. Do we care about that going forward? Looking at these piles of money, there are trust funds in various arenas in the state budget. These are not, it's not unusual necessarily that you tap into that. But does that matter right now?
I don't think it. I mean, for the average person on the street, they're not going to see that or feel that or understand that. So I think the governor has some tricks up his sleeve, as well as the ANF secretary and others within the secretariat, to figure out how to do this in a way that, quite frankly, people don't feel it and don't see it. And there are some things that you can do as governor to make that happen. I'm not sure exactly how the trust fund process works, but I'm hoping that he'll do it in a compassionate way that doesn't impact the Commonwealth and impact the people we care about.
So some of the things we really care about are health care, for instance. Some cuts that we know about so far, $150 million from the state's Medicaid program, below what the House and Senate had previously approved, and reduced another $250 million from, quote, other areas of the budget. And this is Senator Karen Spilka naming some of the cuts.
For education, there's some cuts. We preserved Chapter 70, but we could not preserve the special ed circuit breaker for full funding. There's a cut at youth at risk summer jobs and family resource centers and other areas.
Tiziana Deering, surprised?
No. Like I said before, every time we don't deal with a revenue issue, usually it's the people who have the least voice and the least political and economic power who suffer the burdens in a budget. So, no, I'm not surprised. What does strike me and what I think we need to listen to between the lines is the things that she was just pointing at are things that are, to use a sort of a trite phrase, investments in our future. Right. These are about youth having summer jobs that allow them to fully participate in the economy when they're adults. This is about education, which affects future earnings and multi-generational family stability. So these short-term cuts that we're making to deal with our lack of having appropriate revenues are the kinds of things that can have a generational level impact on our future economic prosperity as a community.
So what's the fix? Is it increasing taxes on the upper income earners in the state?
Well, I think everything's on the table. I think you have folks like the Mass Budget and Policy Center and Noah Berger and his team that have offered suggestions on what we can do around tax revenue. We are no longer Taxachusetts, so there's an opportunity to look at revenue options. And then, you know, there is the tax on the wealthier folks among us. All of that should be on the table. But I know that there is a general resistance, at least on one side in the legislature, to tax increases. I was absolutely disappointed that the tax was not there for the flavored cigars. And that the provision around the Prevention and Wellness Trust Fund, which is actually making a difference in saving lives and people living healthier lives by intervening and giving them the intervention services they need, that didn't make it into this budget.
And that would have been how much?
I don't know what it would have generated. I don't recall. Mm-hmm. But we knew that the Senate was very much in favor of getting this done. The House had not had this in their version, and we were all hopeful it would be there, and it's not.
Right. Yeah, that was actually one of the things that struck me. So here's my public confession. I am a very serious cigar smoker.
Right? Are you?
Oh, for the love of God, tax the flavored cigars. Really? We're not taxing
flavored
cigars.
Well, you know, I drink wine and beer. I'm okay if you. That goes up, too. That's my confession, too. Right? But that said, I want to ask you one other question before we turn to other substances like marijuana. We've got, you said this, and Noah Berger said this. It's like, no, you feel like the lawmakers are not looking ahead at the big picture, at the long-term investments that need to be made to improve the overall government infrastructure separate from roads and water passages and all that. So the big structural issues, when is any state government ever going to be able to catch its breath to do this? And I mean, is there something you can say to that in 30 seconds or less?
Yeah, I mean, it really is about political will to do it. I mean, ultimately, states all over the country are facing the same decision, that they have priorities. They have people that are hurting, that are in need. They have businesses that need investment. They have roads and bridges that need fixed. And you just got to decide how you're going to do it. I think it is one of the most daunting challenges for a legislator. And I don't take that lightly. But you got to find a way to do it.
Yeah, public will or not, you cannot continue to increase expenses and not increase revenues, period. Right. The math just doesn't work.
One of the revenue generators could become marijuana, legal marijuana sales in the state, if anybody could decide what those sales tax will be. So we know that this has also been in the mix on Beacon Hill this week. The conference committee was unable to reach a compromise last week. Self-imposed deadline was Friday. The Senate basically wants the voter-approved law to remain intact. The House is pushing for a couple of big changes. More than doubling what the voters approved, the tax rate would go from 12% to 28% if the House had its way, and giving municipal leaders, towns and cities, rather than the voters, a say on whether to ban the marijuana businesses from opening up in their towns. So we have some understanding that this is all tabled until next week. Do you think, first of all, did this get tangled up with the budget? And is that why we landed on this Friday, you know, waiting to hear still at this point with 7 hours of review time? Well, is this all tangled up?
Well, who knows? I mean, if you listen to both leaders, they were not tangled up. And many of the budget crafters would say it's not tangled up either. It may have been, but we know from the leadership that it is not. So I think it really doesn't matter at this point. We needed both things to get done. I think in terms of the timeline to get this, the regulations around pot shops and taxes and so forth for the marijuana law, it's necessary that we move quickly with all deliberate speed. And I think to Senator Rosenberg's point, we can do both at the same time. Unfortunately, it is suspended until they reconvene after they pass the budget.
Right. Well, let's hear a little bit from Senator Rosenberg. House Speaker Robert DeLeo, we know, unilaterally called off negotiations on the bill to focus on the budget, and that led to a sharp rebuke from State Senate President Stan Rosenberg. Here is WBUR Steve Brown speaking to Rosenberg yesterday afternoon after a compromise was reached on the budget.
Seems that a budget is at hand.
A miracle of miracles. We suspended a unilateral suspension of the Conference Committee on Marijuana, and 24 hours later, miracle of miracles. I've been in this building for about 40 years. That's about the most absurd thing that I have ever seen.
Why absurd?
Well, my snarkometer is certainly going off.
Yeah, no, you can see it from like the fiddler on the roof. You know, you might as well have broken out into song at that point.
Yeah, there was some dripping irony going on there. You know, whether they were tangled or not, it is easy to have one thing cause distractions from another. Right. And deadlines are an interesting part of this entire discussion. Self-imposed deadlines versus real deadlines. For example, why do we need a vote on the budget today? We have an appropriations bill that gets us through the end of the month. Couldn't we vote on it next week when people had more time to look at it? So, you know, some of this entanglement or distraction is not some of it. It all seems to be entirely sort of self-driven. And that's really unfortunate. At the same time, one can understand if you're dealing with too many complex issues at once, sometimes you got to table one to get one done. And that's not necessarily bad or irresponsible.
And Michael Curry, does this reveal any new tensions between Rosenberg and DeLeo? I mean, is it going to hamper political processes going forward in your sense?
No, I don't think it does. I think that there is an inherent tension that exists between the Senate president and the speaker, no matter who they are. I think those chambers have a healthy friction that I think for us as residents of the Commonwealth, we should be thankful for. There are some things you can go to the House and you can get advanced and there'll be resistance in the Senate and vice versa. So I don't see anything new with this, quite frankly, having been through this many other times. I've seen much more friction in this.
Right. Well, one other point on marijuana. So this is another issue of transparency, at least to the voters in another way. This was a ballot initiative voted on, you know, by residents. So is there enough pressure to make lawmakers accountable to voters on this issue, which, again, they approved last November?
Yeah. So somebody I know says that ballot initiatives are two wolves and a sheep voting on what's for dinner. You know, you get in a ballot initiative, it's a very blunt object for creating legislation.
Right.
And I do think, at least to some extent, it's understandable for the legislature to say maybe we don't need every detail of a piece of legislation dictated on the ballot. Maybe there's room for some nuance and adjustment. So this kind of all one side or all the other, it has to be exactly like it came out, or it can't, you know, or we're going to do it entirely differently. Both seem unrealistic, but it does seem like it's appropriate to say, let's go through this legislation and make sure it's enacted smartly, competently, and in a way that's going to be effective.
Okay. Lawsuits, education lawsuits. Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey this week, yesterday, she is leading 18 other attorneys general in suing the Trump administration and Betsy DeVos over student loan protection. So new regulations would have made it easier for students to seek loan forgiveness if the school deceived them or committed fraud. And this was worked on under the Obama administration, was supposed to go into effect July 1st. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos delayed these rules, saying the Obama rules missed the mark and that her department would come up with new regs. Attorney General Maura Healey, this is near and dear to her. She's worked on this issue about for-profit colleges and student loans with some great concern. She argues the Trump administration is siding for for-profit colleges, that they're taking advantage of students and taxpayers.
What she did was illegal, and more importantly, it's unfair. It makes no sense. Unfortunately, though, we have a Secretary of Education and Betsy DeVos who's more interested in protecting the executives of for-profit schools than actually protecting the students whose responsibility it is that her office takes care of.
So this is a priority for Healey's office. Is it something that is a priority as a lawsuit in this state?
I think it should be.
State of education?
Yeah. I mean, this is Massachusetts. We care about education. We care about higher education. And this is really, really important. And what I feel like the attorney general is doing here is it's part of a strategy that she seems to be pursuing to take a stand against this process of essentially systematically dismantling the department you run because you don't believe in the role it plays in government.
Absolutely.
And we certainly seem to be seeing that with Secretary DeVos. And this is just one more example of that.
And it's concerning for all of us who are in this area thinking about education and how to make it work for all of us. And the reality is, you know, I've always often compared the Trump administration to the Bad News Bears. And she's one of the key players in the Bad News Bears, trying to overturn regulations, trying to suspend legal cases that are pending. We are all deeply concerned about this woman. I actually find that even when I talk to charter school advocates who will be benefited by her leadership, they're terrified of her as well.
Interesting. Attorney Dennis Cariello, he represented the for-profit colleges as the Obama rules were negotiated. He says the Obama rules go too far and the simple clerical errors could lead to punishment for the schools.
I mean, you can see one mistake can create an existential crisis at an institution.
So still, rules contested. And if the new administration has concerns, why not reexamine them? Why not give the Trump administration a chance?
Well, you know, there's a difference between giving the Trump administration a chance and leaving absolutely no recourse while they take their time having a chance. And I think that's a really big deal here. I mean, at the risk of sounding glib, and I will, pretty much the only people who are on the side of the for-profit colleges and universities in this are the for-profit colleges and universities,
well said.
Right? So, you know, why can we not enact the regulations while they're being reconsidered? You know, Maura Healey argued herself that this isn't a pause, this is a stop.
Mm-hmm. And I think every statement from a state against an administration right now is carrying some bigger ball, is my hunch. Mm-hmm. Let's have a little light and hope here. Celtics. Who cares about the Celtics? Oh, I see a finger pointing. Okay, so listen, we have Banner 18 could be in sight for the Celtics, right? Maybe Utah Jazz All-Star forward Gordon Hayward says he will sign with the Celts, reuniting with his college coach Brad Stevens. Gordon has agreed to a lovely contract, 4 years, $128 million. Hayward explains his decision on his website, or on the website, the Players Tribune, like this. Unfinished business that he and his coach had together back in 2010 when he left Butler for the NBA, that's Butler College. As far as he's concerned, all of these years later, we still have it, and that's to win a championship. Michael Curry, what do we think? Are we excited?
So I will tell you, I was playing basketball this morning, and I think my poll is that people are pretty excited about him coming to the Celtics. The reality is there's a big divide between us and the Cleveland Cavaliers. This doesn't get us all the way across that divide, but it gets us a significant step in the right direction. We are nowhere near winning a championship.
You heard it here.
This is progress.
All right, you heard it here. You may have heard something else yesterday, but you heard this here. All right, now, we have enough time right now for our hubbubs, which are those smaller stories that don't get a lot of attention this week. Michael, you want to start?
Yeah, I think the interesting story for me as a person who is a student of history is just the old Amelia Earhart story, and it's been dominating the news in the last 2 days, that there's now a potential theory around what happened to her. I was reminded in this story that she has a strong Boston connection, that she had a residence here, that there was a terminal at Logan Airport named after her. I think that, you know, we owe it to history to figure out what happened to Amelia Earhart. So I think that's my hubbub. The many stories that have been covered about her life, the 80 years since she disappeared.
What I love about this is that maybe somebody really didn't hear this and they happen to love this history and love this, and then now they're going to go dig it up. They're going to go Google the heck out of it. So, all right, Tiziana, what's your hubbub?
Oh, I love my hubbub this week. It's about the little boat that could, and a boat and some high school youth who defied expectations. So we had some students who were participating in an alternative high school education program, which usually means they've been labeled as not being able to be successful in traditional school models, right? These young people built a 5-foot sailboat and launched it back in December, unmanned sailboat, 168 days at sea. They were shooting for Ireland. It actually made it to Scotland with the little Lego pirate captain they put in it, still intact at the helm.
Super glued.
I just love it. I just, everything about the expectations
that's
they defied,
I
just think it's
Bush,
fun.
Any Bush funding in there? No, probably not. So I have one. My hubbub takes place in Maine also. It involves super speed and bears, and there is a professional runner whose name is, he's from Kenya. His name is Modina Murube, and he took off running, he's out having a good time. He was running to a vacant house about 20 yards away when this bear was chasing him. He was out just, cruising on Wednesday, and two bears crossed his path, and he beat the bears. He made it to the screened-in porch, and the bears were close behind, but he did it. So we should note that the Maine wildlife officials do not recommend trying to outrun the bear. It says you should appear large and make noises while slowly backing away, and I guess unless you're really fast, that might be an option. So
that's
probably
hilarious.
So. Thank you. Michael Curry, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP, and now with the National NAACP Board of Directors. Thank you so
Thanks
much.
Thanks for having
really
me.
Really nice to meet you, too. And Tiziana Deering, co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College and a member of WBUR's Executive Advisory Board. Great to meet you. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks very much.
This is 90.9 WBUR. This is Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. Alex Ciccolo has been in federal custody since July 4th, 2015. The 24-year-old Adams, Massachusetts man is charged with attempting to commit domestic terrorism. Ciccolo's father, a Boston police captain and among the first responders at the Marathon bombings, was the one who tipped off federal officials his son was becoming, quote, obsessed with ISIS. And that led to an FBI sting where Ciccolo described to a government informant his plans to explode pressure cooker bombs in a crowded place. Ciccolo's parents divorced when he was in grade school, and for a while he lived with his mother on Cape Cod. When he was about 14, he lived with his father and stepmother in Needham. And for years, each parent accused the other of doing a pretty poor job of raising their son. After Ciccolo's arrest, his father made a single statement to the public, and his mother has kept an even lower profile until recently. I went to her home to speak with her about her son.
Can I get you anything to drink?
Oh, great. Thank you. I'm good. I stopped.
Ciccolo's mother, Shelley McInnes, now lives in Peru, Massachusetts.
I've only been in the Berkshires for a little over 7 years.
She works the overnight shift in a substance abuse clinic. She says her son had his own struggles with addiction, and he did have a problem with anger, McInnes says, but he would not hurt innocent people.
He is very compassionate. He has a deep respect and reverence for all living things. I'm sure some people are out there saying, yeah, right, but he literally would not hurt a fly.
That's what McInnes chooses to believe, she says. And if people want to call her naive or stupid, they still can't take that belief away from her. Yet when Ciccolo was first arrested and he stabbed a nurse at the jail with a pen, that shocked her. She thinks he was disoriented. It was halfway through Ramadan. Ciccolo, who'd converted to Islam a few years ago, was fasting.
And he regrets that. He really has remorse for that.
And that stabbing is the one wrong act McInnes directly acknowledges her son committed. Still, she's relieved he's not on the street.
I'm so glad that he's in prison rather than going out somewhere, if he were planning to do that, I don't know, and getting killed.
McInnes is leaning heavily on her Catholic faith, giving all this trouble up to God, she says. And she's learning about her son's beliefs. Several books on Islam are piled on the table in the compact A-frame house she shares with her second husband. It takes about an hour from here to get to Springfield, and it's a drive they take for almost every one of Ciccolo's appearances in federal court. She visits her son in prison in Rhode Island about twice a month.
We actually get as much time as we want. There are visiting hours. They're different during the weekday and during the weekend.
Since Ciccolo was first arrested on July 4th, 2015, quite a bit has been reported about his early life. According to court records obtained by several media outlets, in his teens, Chakola was suspended from school for threatening another student. And then something happened at his father's home in 12th grade. Things got a little physical, McGinnis says.
And Alex, you know, in anger, I guess it got pretty aggressive. So then his father decided to call the ambulance and he was placed in the psychiatric unit.
After Chakola got out, McGinnis says he refused to take medication. He dropped out of high school, left his father's home, stayed at friends' houses, slept in his car. He was drinking and doing drugs. McGinnis says she knew people who ran a Buddhist peace pagoda in New York State, and her son agreed to go there. He found a mentor and stayed in New York for about a year. And eventually, he made his way to Western Mass, not far from his mother.
Yeah, he worked little odd jobs here and there. I think it was construction or landscaping.
2 weeks before the arrest, McGinnis says her son was reclusive and anxious. He told her everything was fine, but she says he was in despair and angry.
About the situation here in the U.S. and the Middle East and around the world, what was happening to his Muslim brothers and sisters, getting killed, how they're being treated.
According to the U.S. Attorney's Office, Chakola is a supporter of ISIS. He's accused of attempting to provide the terrorist group with material support. And physical evidence against Chakola? He received firearms from a person who was cooperating with law enforcement. Several partially constructed Molotov cocktails were found in his apartment. And in recorded conversations, Chakola describes plans to commit acts of terrorism, including setting off explosives where a large number of people congregate, like college cafeterias. McGinnis won't condemn her son for any of these alleged plans. She has empathy for him. That is being a mother, she says.
Without condoning or justifying it.
Is there any way you think, you know, with the allegations, is there any way you think that he thought that he was doing something good by taking the alleged steps that he took to build a bomb?
Absolutely. There's no doubt in our minds that he felt that it was his duty and in the eyes of God to just to step forward and try to do his part, do something. And I think he didn't know what to do. And I think that if he had some confusion or second thoughts, or I think maybe it got to a point that maybe he didn't know who to go to.
In the past, McGinnis says her son told her everything. But she says she had no clue about any of his alleged plots. And whatever her ex-husband knew, McGinnis says going to the FBI was the wrong way to help their son.
People that you see being executed are criminals.
In a videotaped interview with the FBI in the hours after his arrest, Chakola is sitting in a cubicle, kitty-corner to a desk. One leg is crossed over the other. When the agent asks Chakola what he thinks about ISIS, Chakola doesn't answer at first.
They're doing a good thing?
Yeah. Yeah, they are. They're doing a good thing.
Chakola told the agent ISIS will only kill people who fight them. That claim has been disproved repeatedly by the group's attacks in public spaces, cafes, concerts, offices, places of worship.
I'm happy to answer a few questions, folks.
A couple of weeks after that FBI interview, Chakola's attorney, David Hoos, stood outside federal court in Springfield.
One of the things that's hard to convey is the depth of this young man's feeling towards his mother and stepdad. And as I said in court, he would not do anything to put them at risk or in danger.
When asked by a reporter how he thought Chakola's father developed the belief his son was a danger to others, who said this?
We all have children, and our children sometimes fall far from the tree.
And who said he couldn't really elaborate more than that.
Thanks very much, folks.
The FBI has arrested people who have direct ties to ISIS and who don't have any ties, like Alex Chakola and another Boston area man, Tariq Mahana from Sudbury. He was convicted in 2011 on charges he conspired to kill Americans and was sentenced to 17 and a half years in federal prison. Alex Chakola's trial date has not been set, but another hearing, an administrative hearing, is scheduled for next week.
Ciccolo and Mahana, they profess support for ISIS, but some say it's unclear that whether they would have posed a threat had the FBI not encouraged them. And in Ciccolo's case, provided him with weapons. These FBI stings have come under scrutiny by the online publication The Intercept, among others. And we're joined now by Trevor Aronson, a contributing writer for The Intercept and the executive director of Florida's Center for Investigative Reporting. Hi, Trevor. It's good to speak with you again.
Hi, Jill. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So The Intercept keeps this database of FBI stings. It's online. And in the description, you have basically at the top, the U.S. government has prosecuted 805 people for terrorism since the 9/11 attacks. Most of them never even got close to committing an act of violence. Can you explain that? What do you mean?
Yeah, of course. So currently, there have been more than 800 defendants since 9/11. You can take about half of them and classify them as being in plots that were not necessarily violent in nature. This would be raising funds for organizations that are alleged to have terrorist ties or lying to the FBI, for example. But then there's a whole other half that are people who are alleged to have been involved in some sort of plot or some sort of attack. And the vast majority of those are like Alexander Ciccolo's, where it involves someone who generally does not have any direct ties to a terrorist group, whether it's ISIS or Shabab or Al-Qaeda, and generally lacks the weapons or the know-how to acquire those weapons. And it's only through an FBI sting operation that the target is kind of made capable of getting involved in a plot for which he's then prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. And if you take our database of more than 800 defendants, you can really count on, you know, your two hands the number of defendants who were dangerous, like Faisal Shahzad, for example, the man who came close to bombing Times Square, or Najib Olazazi, who came close to bombing the New York City subway system. There are people in this group of 800 who are really dangerous, but the vast majority are not. The vast majority are people like Alexander Ciccolo.
So we don't know, though, whether he is dangerous. I mean, we know this, that he has a history of emotional and physical responses to situations, and I cannot say that he's mentally ill per se. I don't know that you can as a journalist. I have not found that. He did have a plan. It's not clear if he could pull it off, but do you see that in other cases as well, but that the FBI does have a job to do? They do have to do something.
Absolutely. Yeah, I should be clear. You know, people who are mentally ill or, you know, shows signs of some sort of mental illness to a certain extent are a danger, right? I mean, it's how we as a society deal with them. Whether they're terrorists or not is another kind of larger question. And what you see happening here is that the FBI is working today and since 9/11 under a policy of, you know, never again, never another a terrorist attack. And so they are trying to prevent today attacks that will happen tomorrow through a very proactive and preemptive counterterrorism strategy. And what that involves is the use of informants. You know, today the FBI has more than 15,000 of them, and undercover agents who look for people who are espousing some sort of interest in violence or are suggesting they might want to get involved in violence. And when they identify those people, they then push them along and see how far they will go. The idea being, in the FBI's view, that someone like Alexander Ciccolo maybe one day would meet someone who could provide him with the capability, or maybe one day would on his own get that capability. So through this elaborate sting operation, they're going to kind of take him off the field of battle, so to speak, long before he has a chance to hurt anybody else. The problem with that and where the criticism that I and others bring up is that, you know, there has never been a case where someone who is wholly incapable gets assistance from Al-Qaeda or ISIS or another group in the United States, and that in many of these cases, there is a question of capacity. Does he have weapons? Does he have money to get weapons? And also a question of mental fitness. In many of these cases, the target of the sting is mentally ill or has suggestions of mental illness, and their ability to understand what they're doing, their ability to kind of understand their role in a larger, global kind of counterterrorism strategy. I mean, in many cases, as in Alexander Ciccolo's, these people were never actually in contact with ISIS or Al-Qaeda or terrorist groups. They are only kind of members and supporters of the groups
minds. And Trevor Aronson, isn't it that the FBI commits the sting or holds the sting or gets it going, and it's the courts that then provide – that convicts somebody like Alex Ciccolo or not? It's the justice system. I mean, isn't it, as we heard from one of our guests on the show a couple of years ago, Seth Jones from the RAND Corporation's International Security and Defense Policy Center. He said basically it's a good thing that Ciccolo lives in the U.S. because he has or he gets to go through the legal system. And it's the legal system who's going to look for that intent, regardless of the FBI.
Absolutely. I mean, someone like Alexander Ciccolo is in a much better situation than people who are taken to Guantanamo Bay, for example. But at the same time, that isn't to suggest that Alexander Ciccolo is playing within a justice system that is, providing an equal playing field for him. You know, that is to say that what ends up happening in these cases is that the FBI specifically brings weapons into the situation that create mandatory minimum sentences that can be draconian. So in many of these cases, for example, an automatic weapon is used. So one of the guns that Alexander Ciccolo got was an assault rifle. In other cases, it involves a bomb. And those types of weapons trigger mandatory minimum sentences that, if convicted, will result in the defendant going to prison for 30 or more years. And so many defendants face a situation where they look at those odds and they say, okay, if I take this to trial, I'll go to jail for 30 years, or I could plead out and go to jail for 10, 12 and still have the better part of my life after. Mm-hmm. And it's also worth noting, too, that there are, of course, people who take this to trial and argue entrapment and argue that were it not for the government sting and the informant and the undercover agent, they never would have done any of this. And despite, cases where there has been extraordinary evidence of government abuse, and in one case, for example, an informant was caught on tape offering one of the targets $250,000 if he moved forward in the plot, obvious inducement to commit a crime, and they're still found guilty. And, and legal scholars who look at a lot of these cases have basically kind of surmised that, look, if you're Muslim and you're charged with terrorism in the United States, winning on an entrapment defense is almost impossible. And so what the FBI is playing with in a situation like this is basically odds that, when they arrest them, the chance that they are going to get off is slim to none.
Trevor, we have just a minute left, and I do want to tell you, we did call the FBI for a statement regarding Ciccolo and the FBI sting. They declined to comment to us today due to the ongoing investigation and prosecution, and that any questions should be directed to the U.S. Attorney's Office. We have very little time left. You talked to me another time about how the model of what the FBI does now has to change, because after 9/11, this is not arresting people who've done things. It's arresting people who could be doing things. What can you say in 20 seconds on that? It was like there was the mafia and now there's maybe terrorism.
Yeah. I mean, so basically what we're seeing in the counterterrorism effort is an adaptation of a previous policy that the FBI had used with the drug war and with the mafia, which is to say that by helping to create these crimes and these stings, they're creating a hostile environment for these, the people who would break the law or commit crime. So in the mafia example, by running stings, that would make the mafioso wonder, well, hey, is this guy I'm working with an informant or is he a real, mafia member? The same goes for terrorism today. Their goal is to create a situation where a real terrorist may wonder the people he's collaborating with whether they're actually government agents of some sort.
Thank you so much, Trevor Aronson. It's very important to get up in the helicopter on some of these stories. So I appreciate your time. Trevor Aronson is a reporter for The Intercept, recent covering FBI stings, and he's the executive director of Florida's Center for Investigative Reporting. Thanks again.
Thanks.
Quick update for folks. Massachusetts House lawmakers have overwhelmingly approved the state's $40 billion budget, only 9 votes against the measure, which was released earlier this morning. The Senate is taking up the measure. There's more ahead. I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. Let's take a trip back to the late 70s, my time. Jim Rice, Carlton Fisk, Carl Yastrzemski still played for the Red Sox. Saturday Night Fever and Close Encounters of the Third Kind are in the movies. Young Bill Gates is on the cover of Time magazine. And Fleetwood Mac is on the cover of Rolling Stone. And little 13-year-old Lou Cove is on the cusp of becoming a man in those final years of the decade. Not only was he supposed to be preparing for his bar mitzvah, his family had just recently moved to Salem, Mass. From New York City, and he hated it. But a family friend who came to visit around this time changed his life. That friend is Howie Gordon, still a friend. He was a Playgirl centerfold
Mr. November 1978, a friend of Lou Cove's father, and he tapped the young Lou to help him with a campaign to be voted Playgirl's Man of the Year for 1979. Lou Cove's memoir, Lou Cove is sitting across from me as if he even can't believe it, Man of the Year, begins in this year of his life, and he joins us now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you, Jill.
You're welcome. Thank you. This was a great read for many reasons. It brought me back to my childhood, sort of. But
you just brought me back with the music.
That was great music. So, Lou, of course, you know, we're all, you know, it's all very exciting to hear the headline of your memoir being about it, you know, tender young age, Playgirl, Howie Gordon becoming Man of the Year. But we should start there and take us back to Salem and just arriving there and what was going on before Howie and his wife, Carly, came to stay at your house for an extended period of time.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, we had lived in New York City prior to living in Salem. That was a pretty big difference going from, you know, Central Park and the Empire State Building and Zabar's, for those of you who know what Zabar's is. It was, you know, my family was Jewish, but we didn't go to synagogue. We went to Zabar's and we got bagels and lox. But going from that to Salem, which at the time, and Salem has come a long way since then, but it was really a city of, you know, witches and townies and sea captain wannabes. And as you said, I really was not very happy to be there and I wanted to go back. My folks had moved around quite a bit. New York was just one of eight other places we had lived before Salem, and I was only 12 years old.
And your family's from, your parents are from this area?
Right. So Both my parents are from the North Shore. So this was not unfamiliar territory for them. My dad was from Marblehead and my mom was from Lin Lin, the city of sin. You never come out the way you went in.
And so Howie Gordon shows up to visit, and he stays for a while. And what happened?
So he and his wife had just been married in Berkeley, California. They were real deal hippies. I say he, you know, looked like Jeff Bridges and talked like Lenny Bruce on acid. And they were on a honeymoon driving across country. Last stop on the tour was going to be Salem. They were going to stay with us for a couple of weeks and turn around and go back. But they ended up living with us for 12 months in that house on Chestnut Street in Salem. And I was so in awe of this guy, of both of them, but in particular this guy. And the extended stay ostensibly was that my dad was trying to get a grant to hire Howie and have him come and work with him on the War on Poverty. That grant never came through, and months passed, and we were sitting around the house looking for stuff to do.
But he tells you, not without too much hesitation, and your mom and your dad, and by the way, everybody loves him. He's a wonderful family friend, and you have a sister and a brother, and they, you know, everybody was in on this, and neighbors is another story. But he tells you, you know, right off what he's been doing. He's been he posed for Playgirl, and the way you write the story, none of it appears shocking, at least not to you. And even your mother, even though there were some photos shown, wedding pictures, for instance, I don't know how you're going to describe it because I'm not going to do it, in the nude, on your wall, on a sheet, you know, in your living room. But everybody loved this guy. And nobody, and especially yourself at 12, 13, reacted with great shock to who he was.
Right. Well, I should say up front, he had been friends with my dad at that point for probably 6 or 7 years. He had been an intern working for my father in Washington, D.C. many years earlier in the War on Poverty, as I mentioned. He was smart. He is smart, charismatic, funny. Everybody loves him still. But he also was willing to walk on a certain edge that others wouldn't.
Okay. He tapped you to be in this campaign, and I just want to explain, and I want to have you explain further, that Playgirl in the 70s was not much different than Cosmo, I mean on some level. So on the cover in the 70s was like Mark Harmon, you know, from, was this Star Wars, right? Of course, John Voight, Chevy Chase at some point, everybody yep. fully clothed on the cover. It became something else back when we hit into 2000, the magazine, which is now no longer. But back then, Burt Reynolds had been in Cosmo, I believe.
That's right.
And so Howie Gordon being in Playgirl was, to your family, not that big a deal. But how did he tap you, Lou Cove?
Mm-hmm.
Why you? To be the guy to help him with this campaign? To become Man of the Year in the next year.
Right. So
naked.
So we were spending a lot. You're right, and for, let me say, you're right about what the 70s were like and what Playgirl was like at that time. Burt Reynolds had posed in Cosmo.
We were reading Cosmo on the airplanes. You know, we took my
right.
sister and I.
my grandfather had Playgirls in the bathroom. I mean, Playboys in the bathroom for guests. I don't know if everybody's grandfather did, but it wasn't so unusual at the time. Howie represented a bit of a shift for Playgirl. It was erotica for women. And then when he posed, he was the first man ever to appear at full mast. And for many people, that was a break. They felt like that had Playgirl had suddenly gone the way of pornography. But to answer your question...
why you, Lou Combs?
Why
right?
me? Well, why not? I mean, I was the only 12-year-old kid available who could run the campaign.
Well, what did you do? How did this happen?
Right. So what happened was we began walking the streets of Salem, putting together posters, lobbying the girls in the Dunkin' Donuts and the bubbies in my grandmother's living room, everyone that we could get to. And I don't think Howie had any illusion that the work that we were doing was going to ultimately tip the scales one way or the other in of the 4 million votes that came into Playgirl that year for Man of the Year. I think he was, you know, largely doing it to keep me busy. And we were both in Salem, and it was the only place he could run a campaign from. We didn't have the internet at that time. It was all done on foot and all done on paper. But for me, it was the most important political campaign in modern American history.
For you, who was busy experimenting on your own with, you know, finding out who you were sexually. There's you with, I don't know if they were first kisses, but they were, you know, kisses in your room with doors closed and neighbors catching you or out on a window ledge. And so you're really, you know, and you're supposed to be with your Hebrew school tutor, you know,
yes.
getting ready for a major, you know, today you are a man, tomorrow you go back to seventh grade moment.
That's right.
Right. So, so this is a pretty particular time, and your family appears to be on the move, as you said, and loving, but it didn't stay together. Your family didn't stay together. And I'd like you to talk about that, because that's really a major piece of this story. Your parents split.
That's true. And, you know, a lot of people have kind of looked at the story on the surface, as you said, at the kind of sizzling headline and said, oh, it's a coming-of-age story, and the coming-of-age is the exposure to Playgirl magazine and to nudity and stuff. But really, for me, the coming-of-age and certainly the end of the innocence was the end of the family. And the year that Howie and Carly lived in our home ended up being the last best year of my family's life.
And you were really, really ticked off at your father.
Well, I was. It wasn't easy, and it wasn't, and it was clear that it was his decision, and it was, and because it was his decision, he was the one that I turned my anger towards. And I also had a mother who was really hurt, and I could see that. And what, you know, 13-year-old boy isn't going to defend his mom. So,
can you explain how it is then you turn to Howie at this time as well?
Right. So after Howie and Carly left us, and he had won Man of the Year. He had won the national contest, and he had gone on and was trying his hand in Hollywood. You know, he had said to me, if you, you know, this could be my ticket to Hollywood, and I could be the next Starsky, and I want you to be my Hutch. I wanted to be his Hutch. And when he went back to California, I just wanted to go there and be with him and do that, because that looked a hell of a lot better than staying at home and watching my family disintegrate. Ultimately, my parents split, and I was fortunate enough. My mom gave me a plane ticket, and still at a very young age, flew out on my own to California and spent some time in Berkeley with Howie and Carly. And it was at that time that his career was taking off, but not in the way we had imagined. And the glossy sexuality of Playgirl was giving way to not Hollywood films, but adult films. And that became too adult for me. So it really ultimately became a question of, you know, we all want to know more about what it means to be an adult when we're that age. But I started finding where the limits were, mm-hmm. and it became too adult for me. And ultimately, I had to come back home and find my own path.
I came to Boston in 1982 and have lived here for 20 years and stayed in Massachusetts. And there were so many lovely little details that I know about. I came here as a 20-year-old. And they're all throughout the book. So I think Boston readers will get it, you know, that you refer to Sprinkles as Jimmy's. But also, you talk about Laurie Cabot, who was on the Charles Lockwood Era show, the morning mattress, right, on
That's
WBCN.
Right. The big
I think
mattress.
I interned there. And I didn't, it was not a good internship. It was like filing albums or something, or worse, getting coffee, you know, the usual. But Laurie Cabot is your friends with her daughter, Penny, and that was mm-hmm. a major piece of your life, of your growing up life. We don't have a lot of time left. We have less than 2 minutes. Do you want to talk about Penny? Do you want to read anything? Or would you like to, I'd like to ask you about about, you know, now and your kids reading this. I probably shouldn't give you the option as I'm getting that hairy eyeball from a producer. Can't give you the option. Lou, this is my fault because I'm too curious about you. We'll put this up online. Okay. Absolutely. Tell me, your kids, have they read this?
So my kids, my daughter, who happens to be the same age now that I was then, was very forceful about wanting to read it. I was a little reluctant. There's a dedication in the book to my kids saying, you're the same age as we were then, but you're too young to read this. But she's a voracious reader and she's an intelligent reader. And I chose to read it together with her. So we have been sitting and reading through it together. And it's been an eye-opening experience.
I actually can't imagine because I have kept it from my almost 14-year-old daughter who, and I wanted to say full disclosure, you and I know each other slightly from Western Mass. I have done Zumba classes at the same time as your wife and our kids have gone to the same school, but I will not let my daughter read this yet. And she's tried to grab it from me several times.
I won't hold it against
okay,
you, Jill.
Lou Cove, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Great Man of the Year. He's now a senior advisor at the Harold Grinspoon Foundation, not the industry. Thank you so much. You can see more about Man of the Year, PG Pictures only, on our website, radioboston.org. Our show is produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, Allison Ruzick, with help from Caitlin O'Keefe and Sean Bowden. Tim Skog is our technical director. Thanks also to Renee, our executive director, Satash Hati. I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston.